of windows to the past, let us open this one to the west and see how some spiritually distinguished souls caught the light of the earliest rays of the rising sun of Baha'u'llah's revelation coming from the east. Regrettably, because of limited time on audio tape, this presentation can tell you brief stories of only a few believers. Many other outstanding teachers and hands of the cause deserve to be remembered. Highlights of their lives can be found in volumes of the Baha'i World and International Record, or in biographies. The following brief accounts are like gazing at a small portion of the brilliant galaxy of immortal heroines and heroes who devoted their energies, talents, their very lives to the faith of Baha'u'llah. May the examples of devotion these souls bequeath to us inspire us to love and live the faith with all the fervor of our hearts. We will start by speaking of Thornton Chase. What a distinction! He is known as the first in the Western world to embrace the cause of Baha'u'llah. He is the first American believer. Abdu'l-Bahá called him Sabit, meaning steadfast. Mr. Chase attended classes given by Ibrahim Kairala in Chicago in 1894 and 1895. While there were four others at the same time who professed to believe in Baha'u'llah, they did not remain committed to that belief as Mr. Chase did. His steadfastness earned him the distinction of being the first Baha'i in America. Kairala's refusal to accept Abdu'l-Bahá as the sole authorized head of the Baha'i faith led to a crisis at the turn of the century. Some became disheartened by the rebellion of Kairala against Abdu'l-Bahá, but not Thornton Chase. Such were his qualities of heart and mind that nothing could remove his devotion to Abdu'l-Bahá as the one appointed by Baha'u'llah to be the singular leader of the Baha'i faith. Mr. Chase was a very articulate man, both in speaking and writing. In 1911, he wrote a 19-verse poem entitled El Abha, an ode to the mysterious spiritual powers of Abdu'l-Bahá, which can be found in Star of the West magazine, Volume 3, Number 12. Mr. Chase made a pilgrimage in April 1907 to the shrine of Baha'u'llah and attained the presence of Abdu'l-Bahá, who was then a prisoner of the Turkish Empire. Undoubtedly, this was the greatest event of his life. He wrote of his experiences there in a booklet called In Galilee. One quote from it, referring to Abdu'l-Bahá, quote, "As each hungry pilgrim comes to that prison house, that banquet hall of heavenly gifts, he takes him in his arms and draws him to his breast with such sincerity and enthusiasm of love that the petty cares of the world vanish away, and one is at peace and in happiness because he has reached home and found love there." End quote. Interestingly, the birthday of Thornton Chase was February 22, 1847, which, 115 years earlier, was the birthday of President George Washington. His family in Springfield, Massachusetts, was Northern Baptist, and he was given the best education possible. His earliest time of manhood found him serving on the Northern forces of the Civil War, becoming a captain. Mr. Chase loved music, had a magnificent singing voice, and was a student of religious thought, searching for a cause that would embody the Day of God. Great expectation of the return of Christ swept the Western world in the 1840s. The religious fervor must have made a deep impression on the young Thornton Chase. For some time before he heard of the Baha'i faith, he was a follower of the noble and mystical teachings of Emanuel Swedenborg. Mr. Chase was working as an insurance salesman based in Chicago when a friend told him what he had learned of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá from Ebrahim Kairullah, a Syrian believer who emigrated to the United States, not primarily as a Baha'i teacher, but for business ventures. Ever searching, Mr. Chase entered the classes offered by Kairullah. However, Kairullah mixed his own imaginings and doubts about Abdu'l-Bahá into his presentations on the Baha'i faith. To counter the effects of this, Abdu'l-Bahá in 1900 and 1901 sent teachers to America who were completely loyal to the center of the covenant and well-informed on the teachings of Baha'u'llah. They were Mirza Abul Fazl and Mirza Asadullah. Mr. Chase wrote, quote, "With these teachers came the first opportunity for a correct and intimate knowledge of the true Baha'i teachings, rather than psychic and occult experiments. Many persons who had conceived views, imbued with imaginations and superstitions, fell away from the cause. But those who remained discovered such spiritual light and power in the teachings that they were deeply confirmed in their belief and clung to it." End quote. This is from a short paper entitled A Brief History of the American Development of the Baha'i Movement, printed in Star of the West, Volume 5, Number 17. It is fascinating to observe that notwithstanding Mr. Chase's obvious position as one of the greatest pillars of the Baha'i community in America, in this paper he makes no reference to himself whatsoever. What an example of self-effacement and humility. Mr. Chase's business career involved a great deal of travel. In each city he visited, he would introduce the faith to many people and spend a good deal of time teaching seriously interested individuals. The insurance company he worked for transferred him to Los Angeles, California, by one account about 2 years before he passed away. It is reported that the company decided to do this in the hope that once removed from the center of Baha'i activity in Chicago, he would spend more time working and less time on the faith. It did not turn out that way. In California, he became a close friend of John David Bush, whose story will also be told later on. Thornton Chase was a very tall and handsome figure, whose security and joy in the faith came through his personality. It is written that a secretary in an office which he visited from time to time spoke in later years of the electrifying presence of Thornton Chase. She recalled that whenever he came into the room, people felt elated. Joy wafted in with him. His face radiated light. Others wrote of him that he inspired love and trust, that one never heard a word of condemnation or criticism from him, that he was a man of great loving character, with a heart that drew to him warm friends and a love which seemed to reach out, surround, and envelop you. He wrote many pamphlets to help in teaching the Baha'i faith and a book, The Baha'i Revelation, which filled a great need at that time for a clearly written exposition of the teachings. 1912 was the exciting year of Abdu'l-Bahá's journey through America. The Baha'is in California were eagerly anticipating the arrival of Abdu'l-Bahá in October. In September, Mr. Chase suffered an illness and never recovered. Abdu'l-Bahá traveled to Los Angeles and visited his grave in Inglewood Cemetery. Standing at the head of the grave, he turned towards the east, raised his hands to heaven, and chanted a prayer, then spoke in praise of Mr. Chase, saying, quote, "This is a personage who will not be forgotten. For the present, his worth is not known, but in the future it will be inestimably dear. His sun will be ever shining. His star will ever bestow the light." End quote. At a later meeting, The master said, quote, "As many times as possible, at least once a year, you should make it a point to visit his tomb, for his spirit will be exhilarated through the loyalty of the friends. And in the world of God will it be happy. The friends of God must be kind to one another, whether it be in life or after death. I loved Mr. Chase very much indeed. His heart was pure. He had no other aim except service to the cause. The Blessed Perfection has invited him to his kingdom. At this very moment, he is submerged in the sea of his bounty." End quote. Many of us have heard of and possibly traveled to Bosch Baha'i School, now located in the Redwood Forested Hills, north of Santa Cruz, California. Do we know it had its beginnings in another location as a gift of land in 1927 from a very generous couple, John David Bosch and his wife Louise? John David Bosch was born in Switzerland in 1855. His family was very religious followers of a Protestant faith. He also knew the teachings of Emanuel Swedenborg, a Swedish mystic of the 18th century. In his teens, he left home and went to Germany, France, and Spain to study winemaking. When 24 years old, he came to America, first to Nebraska, where he worked on railroad construction, then in Oklahoma as a cowboy. These rugged occupations possibly gave him incentive to find a place where he could use his education as a winemaker, which he did as superintendent of a winery in California. His career was extremely successful, and he acquired much land in 3 California counties. But material success did not deter him from his spiritual quest. In 1905, as John was traveling by train, he happened to meet an acquaintance who was reading a book called Abbas Effendi, His Life and Teachings. This refers to Abdu'l-Bahá, whose given name was Abbas. Just think, in such a moment, his life work, which seemed so settled and satisfying, was about to be turned to another course. He wanted to get a copy of the book, and the friend referred him to contact Mrs. Helen Goodall of Oakland. He attended meetings at her home, which were not totally to his taste, as he was the only man in a group of 30 to 40 women in a tea party sort of setting. Yet their focus on the teachings of Baha'u'llah kept him attending, and that same year he wrote to Abdu'l-Bahá requesting acceptance as a believer. Before long came a great test of faith, of detachment and obedience. In 1910 he received a tablet from Abdu'l-Bahá, quote, "According to the texts of the Book of Akdas, both light and strong drinks are prohibited. I hope thou mayest become exhilarated with the wine of the love of God. The after effect of drinking is depression, but the wine of the love of God bestoweth exaltation of the spirit." End quote. He divested himself of his positions in the winemaking business in obedience to the teachings he loved. What bounties would eventually be showered upon him by Abdu'l-Bahá for giving up a business that he no doubt enjoyed and was a recognized expert, being the supervisor of 4 wineries. When John heard that Abdu'l-Bahá would soon be arriving in America, he simply could not wait for the possibility that Abdu'l-Bahá might be able to come to California. So he took a train bound for the east and arrived at the hotel in New York where the master was staying. Of his first moments in Abdu'l-Bahá's majestic presence, John reminisced, quote, "I went as a businessman, I had some questions to ask. When I saw him, I forgot everything." End quote. Then Abdu'l-Bahá told John all the things he planned to ask. He said to Abdu'l-Bahá, "Oh, Abdu'l-Bahá, I came 3,000 miles to see you." Abdu'l-Bahá responded with hearty laughter and said, "I came 8,000 miles to see you." An unexpected privilege soon came to John. Abdu'l-Bahá said to him, "You are one of the family. Come, any time you want to." A tour of New York by car was planned for Abdu'l-Bahá, who made John sit next to him. As soon as the drive started, John relates that Abdu'l-Bahá sighed deeply, put his head on John's shoulder, close, like a child, and went to sleep. Can you imagine the blessed head of Abdu'l-Bahá resting on your shoulder? The touch of his pure white silky hair and the fragrance of holiness arising to surround you. No wonder John was enthralled and entranced. Abdu'l-Bahá gave John the name Nurani, meaning filled with light. He followed the master everywhere for about 3 weeks and then returned to California. He petitioned Abdu'l-Bahá to extend his trip to California, and it was accepted. John must have been overjoyed when Thornton Chase moved to California. They became close friends, but sadly, Mr. Chase, who was 8 years older than John, passed away suddenly a few days before Abdu'l-Bahá arrived in California. Another good friend of John's was Luther Burbank, horticultural scientist and genius in plant hybridizing, who lived in the same region as the Boches. John made Burbank well acquainted with the Baha'i teachings, and he was favorably impressed. When the tablets of the divine plan came from Abdu'l-Bahá, Mr. and Mrs. Boche eagerly responded by going to Tahiti in 1920. The Tahitians bestowed a title on John meaning, "First King of the Great Family of Baha'is Arrived Among Us." In 1921, they embarked on a teaching trip through Europe on their way to Haifa for pilgrimage, arriving mid-November. What joy and happiness to see their beloved master again after 9 years! John was the last Westerner to receive from the hands of Abdu'l-Bahá a fruit from his garden. At that moment, no one could imagine that in 3 days, the master would be gone. John recalled that the master walked straight and vigorously like a young man. He looked well and strong. In the pre-dawn of November 28, John and Louise were awakened to the stunning and awful word that Abdu'l-Bahá had suddenly passed away. John was asked to help lift the coffin. Except for enemies of the light, Abdu'l-Bahá was adored and revered by high and low in Palestine. It was the Boche's destiny to witness that adoration by seeing 10,000 mourners following the cortege up Mount Carmel to the place of interment in the shrine of the Bab. The greatest holy leaf, Abdu'l-Bahá's sister, requested John and Louise to remain in Haifa for the 40 days of mourning. During this time, Shoghi Effendi returned from England. He gave them the first copy of the translated will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá for the Baha'is in America. Back home again, they made frequent teaching trips in the West Coast states in the service of the beloved guardian, Shoghi Effendi. In 1927, the National Spiritual Assembly appointed a committee to find a location for a Western state Baha'i summer school. John Bosch was on that committee and recalled that in 1919, he had offered his Geyserville property to Abdu'l-Bahá to be used for Baha'i gatherings. This was accepted and the first session opened on his 72nd birthday. This made the guardian very happy, who wrote that the school would, quote, flourish and attract an increasing number of spiritually minded, capable souls who would reinforce the work that is being achieved for our beloved cause, end quote. John lived to see 20 sessions at Geyserville Baha'i Summer School. How happy it must have made them both to see what their gift meant to the spiritual growth of so many Baha'is and seekers. Some years later, the school was renamed Bosch Baha'i School and relocated near Santa Cruz. John passed away July 22, 1946. So loved was he that the village stores closed on the day of his funeral. The Guardian's cablegram read in part, profoundly grieved passing, dearly beloved, great-hearted, high-minded, distinguished servant of Baha'u'llah, John Bosch. His saintly life, pioneer services, historic contribution of institution of summer school, entitle him to rank among outstanding figures of the closing year of heroic and opening years of formative age of the Baha'i dispensation. In 1897, about 2 years after Thornton Chase was confirmed as a follower of Baha'u'llah, another class of Ebrahim Kerala's included a young woman who, after her passing, was extolled by the Guardian as the Mother Teacher of the West, and one of the 19 Disciples of Abdu'l-Bahá and Heralds of the Covenant in the West. What were the events in her short life of only 45 years that culminated in such a station of greatness? Louisa Aurora Moore was born November 1, 1871, into a farm family near the village of Hume in upstate New York. She was an unusually talented child, speaking eloquently and singing beautifully. She was encouraged to develop these talents and inexplicably chose to study in Chicago instead of the closer and recognized Center of Theater Arts, New York City. She may have heard of Kerala's classes on the Baha'i faith in Chicago from Dr. Chester Thatcher, a Baha'i, for whom she worked as a housekeeper. Shortly after completing the class, she married another student, Dr. Edward Getzinger, who accepted Baha'u'llah a few months later. Her zeal and fervor for the newly found faith were intense, as she had been brought up in an atmosphere of great religious excitement about the imminent return of Christ. She returned to New York State to share the new faith with her family and friends. Dr. Getzinger and Lua also went to the West Coast upon the invitation of Phoebe Hearst, the wife of California Senator George Hearst. According to Dr. Getzinger's memoirs, Mrs. Hearst had read of him in a newspaper in 1897. The Getzingers organized a class to share the Baha'i teachings as much as was understood at that time. Mrs. Hearst and many others accepted the faith. Later, in 1898, Mrs. Hearst's butler, Robert Turner, also became a believer. He was the first black American to have become a Baha'i. These new Baha'is longed to see Abdu'l-Bahá, the living center of the faith of his father. Mrs. Hearst had a tour of Egypt planned for the fall of 1898. Then it became possible to attain the presence of the Master, Abdu'l-Bahá, who was a prisoner of the Turkish Empire in Akka, not very far from Egypt. She invited the Getzingers, Robert Turner, and several others to be her guests on this historic first pilgrimage of Western believers. The party broke their journey by stopping at Mrs. Hurst's apartment in Paris. Friends of Mrs. Hurst and two of her nieces were already at the apartment. The friends were May Ellis Bowles, then 28 years old, her mother and her brother. The story of May and her husband, Sutherland Maxwell, will be told next. When May realized there was a religious mission within the travel plans, she became eagerly interested. Lua told her all she knew of the wonders of the new revelation. May and Mrs. Hurst's nieces became believers in a short time and were invited to join the pilgrimage. Because of the dangers surrounding Abdu'l-Bahá, only a few could go to Acre at one time. They had to go first to Cairo, Egypt, and await instructions from Abdu'l-Bahá. Dr. and Lua Getzinger were chosen to be the first North American Baha'is to attain the presence of the Master. It was December 10th, 1898, when they were ushered into his presence, an experience of such spiritual magnitude that their lives were changed forever. Lua wrote to Thornton Chase, "When I left America, I thought I knew a good deal. But after seeing the Master, I am sure I know nothing. The face of the Master is gloriously beautiful. His eyes read one's very soul. Still, they are full of divine love and fairly melt one's heart." Dr. Getzinger wrote, "When I first saw the servant of Baha, in spite of my former belief, atheism, I still had enough spiritual perception to see at once a holy man, a divine character, a soul that I could not comprehend, and at that moment I consecrated my life and all to the principles for which he stands." Abdu'l-Bahá permitted the Getzingers to stay in Acre for 5 months to learn Persian and to acquire deeper knowledge of the Baha'i faith. They found discrepancies between what Kerala had taught them and what they were now learning from Abdu'l-Bahá himself, such as reincarnation, which is rejected in the Baha'i teachings. When the Getzingers returned to America in May 1899, they had some precious gifts to share with the friends, in addition to a greatly expanded and corrected knowledge. The gifts were the first photograph ever taken of Abdu'l-Bahá. This was made in 1868 in Adrianople when Abdu'l-Bahá was 24 years old. Also, a calligraphic design of the greatest name, an Arabic copy of the Kitab-e Aqdas, and a wax cylinder recording of the chanting of Abdu'l-Bahá. Dr. Getzinger had actually taken a phonograph with him, and Abdu'l-Bahá graciously consented to the recording, which exists to this day. Can you imagine the excitement and joy of the American believers to have these infinitely precious things brought to them? How many Baha'is were there in America in 1899? According to the carefully researched and fascinating book, The Baha'i Faith in America, Volume 1 by Dr. Robert Stockman, membership had grown from 2 believers in 1894 to 1,467 by September 1899. As mentioned in the story on Thornton Chase, Ebrahim Kerala became proud and ambitious and was maneuvering to make himself the official leader of the Baha'is in America, in direct opposition to the explicit commands of the will and testament of Baha'u'llah, which appointed his son Abdu'l-Bahá as the only authority and interpreter of the faith. When the Getzingers returned to America, they found the infant Baha'i community being sorely tried and divided over the issue. The Getzingers, among others of capacity, immediately took up the challenge of strengthening the understanding and loyalty of their fellow believers towards Abdu'l-Bahá. Lua made several trips to Akka and served Abdu'l-Bahá in special ways. Once she stayed in Akka for a year and taught English in the household of Abdu'l-Bahá. Abdu'l-Bahá loved to hear her sing. When she sang, "Nearer, my God, to thee," it would bring tears to his eyes. Another time, when Lua was back in America, she received a stunning letter and command from Abdu'l-Bahá. Enclosed was a letter written by Abdu'l-Bahá to the Shah of Persia, who was in Paris at the time, and Lua was instructed to personally deliver it to the Shah. It was a time of great persecution and killing of Baha'is in Persia, and Abdu'l-Bahá was petitioning the Shah to stop the shameful and barbaric actions. Lua traveled to Paris post-haste, only to be turned away because the son of the Prime Minister was very ill and not expected to live. She extracted the promise of an appointment if the child would be healed overnight. Lua united with the Baha'is in Paris in an all-night prayer vigil. With no doubt about the outcome, she returned to the Prime Minister's office the next day and was told that the child was recovering. The petition was thus presented to the Shah, and for a time the persecution was halted. Abdu'l-Bahá's trip to America in 1912 filled the Baha'is with indescribable excitement and joy. Many who would never have been able to go to Akka to attain his presence now found their heart's desire coming to them. Lua was on a speaking tour in California when Abdu'l-Bahá arrived in New York in April. On April 29th, he arrived in Chicago and addressed the concluding session of the Baha'i Temple Unity Convention the next day. This is where Lua first saw her beloved master in America. May 1st, 1912, was the very special day when, under a large tent, surrounded by the spellbound believers, Abdu'l-Bahá laid the cornerstone for the future Mashriq-ul-Azkar, or House of Worship. After that, Abdu'l-Bahá returned to New York, and Lua followed him. In New York, the Baha'i artist Juliet Thompson had gained the permission of Abdu'l-Bahá to paint his portrait. Lua was there also in Juliet's studio. As he sat very still for the painter, he seemed to be going to sleep, but suddenly opened his eyes and addressed the women on the meaning of the covenant of God with such power that they were awestruck. Juliet's diary records that it was at that moment that Abdu'l-Bahá spoke directly to Lua and said, "I appoint you, Lua, as a herald of the covenant. Go forth and proclaim this truth." He instructed her to go to California and continue teaching. She was a dynamic speaker and drew large audiences. She very badly wanted to stay near Abdu'l-Bahá and tried some delaying tactics. One was the well-known story of walking in poison ivy. The painful condition was quickly healed with a remedy from the master. With a new understanding about obedience being the expression of love, she traveled to California, where she was blessed by the presence of Abdu'l-Bahá again in the fall. He gave her the title Leva, meaning banner. In 1914, Abdu'l-Bahá directed Lua to teach in India, especially to further acquaint the Maharaja of Jalawar with the Baha'i teachings. The Maharaja had met Abdu'l-Bahá in London and admired him and the Baha'i cause. Lua's health was not very strong, Her husband wrote, "She never spared herself. In a state of utter exhaustion, she would pull herself together by sheer willpower in order to keep her appointments." Upon returning from India, she stayed in Haifa with Abdu'l-Bahá's family for 7 months. It was the summer of 1915, and the world war had started. Abdu'l-Bahá told Lua she must return to America, as he knew conditions would become very dangerous in Palestine. The ship she took stopped in Cairo, and Lua disembarked to see the Baha'is there. She became very ill and unable to continue her journey. She was cared for by a Baha'i family, and in times of returning strength she was engaged in teaching the faith and English lessons. On May 2, 1916, she passed away from heart failure. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote a loving tribute and supplication, in part, "O Lord, grant her a palace in the neighborhood of thy most great mercy. Cause her to dwell in the gardens of thy paradise, the Most High. Illumine her countenance with the effulgence of thy good pleasure in the kingdom of thy glory." A few words about Dr. Edward Getzinger, who was born in 1866 in Frankenmuth, Michigan. At age 7, he ran away and was taken into the home of a professor, who must have had a great influence on the lad. Edward got a medical education and also was a lifelong student of astronomy and the Bible. He was an atheist before becoming a Baha'i, finding its clear logic powerful enough to dispel his disbelief in a divine creator. With the assistance of Mrs. Phoebe Hearst, he published the first book of Baha'i holy writings and The Hidden Words in America. He passed away in 1935. When Mrs. Phoebe Hearst, Lua, and Dr. Getzinger, and others in her company, made the first historical pilgrimage of Western believers to see Abdu'l-Bahá in Acre, Palestine, in 1898, they stopped en route at Mrs. Hearst's apartment in Paris. Residing there were her two nieces and her friend, Mary Martin Bowles, and Mrs. Bowles' adult children, May and Randolph. Who could imagine that the very fragile May, who had been almost bedridden for 2 years, would soon become such a stalwart and courageous follower of Baha'u'llah that 42 years later, after ceaseless activity for the faith, would lay down her life as a martyr in a foreign land. May Ellis Bowles was born on January 14, 1870, in Englewood, New Jersey. As a young girl, she had very unusual spiritual sensitivity. When she was only 11, she experienced in a dream a light so brilliant that upon awakening, she was blinded for a day. Another time, she had a vision of the Master, Abdu'l-Bahá, thinking the identity of the vision was Jesus, until the realization came to her after meeting the Master. She spent 11 years in Paris with her mother and brother, who was attending a school for architectural studies. When Mrs. Hearst's traveling companions met May for the first time, she sensed something special about Lua Getzinger. When May's inquiries revealed that there was a religious mission to their trip, Lua's explanation of the return of Christ changed the direction of May's life. Almost in an instant. She always called Lua her spiritual mother, and they became closest friends. May and Mrs. Hearst's nieces, in a short time, declared their belief in Baha'u'llah, and by their earnest desire, were invited to join the pilgrimage. Because of the restrictions on Abdu'l-Bahá, a prisoner of the Turkish Empire, the pilgrims could not go in one group. May's turn came in February 1899. For one so spiritually attuned, the first encounter with Abdu'l-Bahá was almost too powerful. She wrote, quote, "I found myself at his feet, and he gently raised me and seated me beside him, all the while saying some loving words in Persian, in a voice that shook my heart. I had been carried suddenly to too great a height. My soul had come in contact with the divine spirit, and this force, so pure, so holy, so mighty, had overwhelmed me. To me, he said, 'You are like the rain which is poured upon the earth, making it bud and blossom and become fruitful. So shall the Spirit of God descend upon you, filling with fruitfulness, and you shall go forth and water his vineyard. Now your troubles are ended, and you must wipe away your tears.'" End quote. She was troubled with illness while on pilgrimage. At one time the master cancelled a meeting on Mount Carmel with the pilgrims, saying, "We could not go and leave one of the beloved of God alone and sick. We could none of us be happy unless all the beloved were happy." A little later, a 3-day trip was planned to the shrine of Baha'u'llah, but May found herself ill again the night before. Confiding in Lua that she didn't think Abdu'l-Bahá realized she was too weak for the occasion, Lua said, "You will soon realize something of the power of Abdu'l-Bahá." May relates in her record called An Early Pilgrimage, quote, "It was about dawn when I awoke, feeling myself stirred by a breeze. I cannot describe what followed, but through my soul was flowing an essence. A mighty, unseen force was penetrating all my being, expanding it with boundless life and love and happiness, lifting and enfolding me in its mighty strength and peace. I knew then it was the Holy Spirit of God, and that our Lord was praying for his servants in that blessed dawn. I arose and prayed and was quite well." End quote. After experiencing such a spiritual healing, no wonder May's love for the Master was boundless, and she eagerly obeyed his bidding. All too soon the time of departure from his blessed presence was at hand. He comforted the weeping pilgrims with these words, quote, "Now the time has come when we must part, but the separation is only of our bodies. In spirit we are united. Ye are the lights which shall be diffused. Ye are the waves of that sea, which shall spread and overflow the world. Another commandment I give unto you, that you love one another even as I love you. Look at me and be as I am. You must die to yourselves and to the world. So shall you be born again and enter the kingdom of heaven." End quote. Abdu'l-Bahá directed May to return to Paris and teach. Her fellow pilgrims returned to America. She was the lone Baha'i on the European continent, but not for long. In 4 years, the Paris group of Baha'is numbered between 25 and 30. With her spirit ablaze from the experience of her pilgrimage, she taught her friends and their friends The ever-widening ripples of interpersonal contact drew in souls of great capacity, such as the first French believer, Hippolyte Dreyfus, the first English believer, Thomas Breakwell, and Agnes Alexander, who became a hand of the cause. This extensive teaching was done with very little literature. Only a few prayers and the hidden words were available in English. In 1901, the master sent the great Baha'i scholar Mirza Abul Fazl with translators to further educate the Paris group. May became engaged to William Sutherland Maxwell of Montreal, Canada, an architectural student at the same school her brother attended. They were married in London in May 1902, and she left the lively group in Paris to begin married life in Montreal. A lone Baha'i again, no other Baha'i in all of vast Canada, but not for long. In 1903, her husband entered the faith, becoming the first Canadian Baha'i. Their home was a radiant center of hospitality and teaching, from which they and many others traveled to all parts of Canada, establishing new Baha'i groups and assemblies. What was her method? It was pure love and patience. From a letter she wrote in 1915, quote, "We must first touch the heart to awaken it. If it opens and responds, we must sow the priceless seed. Prepare the soil with the warmth of your love, just as the sun prepares the soil in the spring. In a kind way, try to remove prejudices. Never oppose people's ideas and statements, but give them a little nobler way of seeing life. My great and wise teacher, Mirza Abul Fazl, laid down these divine principles of teaching. He showed me that it is the Spirit of God that is doing the work. We must wait upon the Spirit and do its bidding only." End quote. 10 years passed, and she had the privilege of another pilgrimage, this time with her husband. Their prayer and longing was to be able to have a child, which came true a few years later. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote, quote, "Praise be to God that thy prayer is answered and thy desire realized. In the garden of existence a rose has blossomed with the utmost freshness, fragrance, and beauty. I beg of God that this little child may become great and wonderful in the divine kingdom." End quote. They named her Mary. In 1937, the guardian, Shoghi Effendi, chose her for his wife. How perfectly was the prayer of the master fulfilled for this child. She was elevated to the rank of Hand of the Cause in 1952, a talented author, a world traveler, eloquent speaker, all for the advancement of the faith. She is known to us as Amatul Baha Ruhia Khanom. May Maxwell was also a civic leader. She supported a children's court in Montreal and a milk distribution service for children, and started the first Montessori school in Canada. Such was her admirable reputation as a Baha'i in the city that when the master came to Montreal in 1912, there was, in his words, no antagonist and no adversary. What excitement and joy for the believers in Montreal when the master came! May made the majority of arrangements. Abdu'l-Bahá gave 7 public lectures. At one in a Methodist church, there were 1,200 in attendance. He addressed 4 meetings in the Maxwell home, which is now a Baha'i sacred place. The Maxwell's service on Baha'i institutions in Canada included years on the Spiritual Assembly of Montreal, the National Spiritual Assembly, plus many other activities for Baha'i publications, schools, youth, and racial unity. Her love for the master was so deep that his passing away was extremely hard on her. Amatol Baha Ruhia Khanom writes, quote, "She suffered a complete breakdown in health caused by the shock of his death. For a year we did not know if she would live or die. My father felt that the only hope of dispelling the grief was for her to make the pilgrimage to Haifa again, this time to see the young successor of Abdu'l-Bahá. In April 1923, we arrived in Haifa, and it was Shoghi Effendi who literally resurrected a woman who was so ill she could not walk a step. From that time, the love of my mother's heart became entirely centered in the guardian. She once more served the cause very actively." End quote. In 1935, inspired by the guardian's appeal for pioneers to go to Europe, she spent 2 years there with Mr. Maxwell, their daughter, and two relatives, teaching in Germany, Belgium, and France, concluding the sojourn with a pilgrimage to the sacred shrines. The Maxwells returned to Montreal in fall of 1937, but without Mary, who then made Haifa her home. The Guardian's call for pioneers to go to Central and South America captivated May's restless spirit. With the approval of the Guardian and her husband, May and her niece made the long journey by ship to South America, arriving in Buenos Aires in February 1940. But her spiritual influence there was destined to be from beyond this world of time and space. 3 days after arriving, she suddenly passed away. The Guardian's tribute entitled her as Abdu'l-Bahá's beloved handmaid and distinguished disciple, and gave her the priceless honor of a martyr's crown, because she laid down her life in such a spirit of consecration and self-sacrifice. Some words of the spiritual attraction she radiated are remarkable. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote, "May Maxwell is really a Baha'i. Whosoever meets her feels from her association the susceptibilities of the kingdom. Her company uplifts and develops the soul." Her daughter wrote, "I don't think I ever knew anyone who inspired the love Mother did, so that it was like an event when one was going to see her. And this I felt all my life. It never became commonplace." Juliet Thompson, a close friend, wrote of May being so fragile, so luminous, the most delicate, perfect beauty, flower-like and star-like. William Sutherland Maxwell occupies a unique position in Baha'i history, as he became in 1903 the first Canadian Baha'i. 37 years later, the Guardian appointed him to be the architect of the majestic Shrine of the Bab, and in 1951 he was the first Canadian Baha'i to be named a Hand of the Cause. He was born into a distinguished family of Montreal and studied architecture at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. He became one of the finest architects in Canada and held the positions of President of the Royal Architectural Institute of Canada and Vice President of the Royal Canadian Academy. Immediately after the passing of Mr. Maxwell's wife, the Guardian invited him to come and reside in Haifa. He became the Guardian's close friend, trusted and gifted collaborator in designing the superstructure of white marble over the Shrine of the Bab on Mount Carmel. After 2 years of work on the preparations, on the 100th anniversary of the Declaration of the Bab, May 22, 1944, the Guardian announced that the design was chosen. Because of the aftermath of the war years, actual work on it could not start until 1948. After 11 years in Haifa, Mr. Maxwell made a trip to Montreal to visit relatives. While there, he passed away in March 1952. The Maxwells had willed their historic home in Montreal to the Canadian National Assembly. The Guardian's memorial extolled his saintly life, his services in Canada, and pronounced that one of the doors of the Bob's tomb is named after him as a tribute to his services. This is a brief account of Thomas Breakwell, the first English Baha'i who was mentioned in the story about May Bowles Maxwell. Abdu'l-Bahá refused to give permission for May to leave Paris in the summer of 1901, much to the annoyance of May's mother, who wanted her to leave for a vacation place. The reason for Abdu'l-Bahá's decision soon became apparent when a friend of hers brought a young Englishman to meet May, feeling that he would be interested in hearing about the Baha'i teachings. The following are excerpts from May's reminiscence about Breakwell. Quote, "I shall never forget opening the door and seeing him standing there. It was like looking at veiled light. I saw at once his pure heart, his burning spirit, his thirsty soul. He stayed a short time. As he was leaving, he said that Mrs. Milner told him that I had received some teachings which had a great effect on my life, and he would like to hear what I could tell him. We made an appointment for the following morning. At the appointed hour, he arrived, his eyes shining, his face illumined, his voice vibrating under the stress of great emotion. He looked at me very intently and then said, 'I have come to you to help me. Yesterday, after I left you, I walked alone down the boulevard, and suddenly some great force nearly swept me off my feet. I stood still as though awaiting something, and a voice announced to me distinctly, "Christ has come." Then he said, "What do you think this means?" Then I gave him the message and teachings from the beginning. He was like a blazing light. Such was his capacity that he received the message in all its fullness and all its strength and beauty within 3 days, and on the third day he wrote his supplication to Abdu'l-Bahá, which in its force and simplicity I have never seen equaled." End quote. The supplication which Thomas wrote to Abdu'l-Bahá was this: "My Lord, I believe, forgive me, thy servant, Thomas Breakwell." What is it that he implores forgiveness from the Master? We will learn that in a little while. Thomas now had only one great longing: to meet the Master. May wrote to the Master asking permission for her young friend to make the pilgrimage and enclosed his supplication. That same day, when May went to get her mail, there was a cablegram from Abdu'l-Bahá. It said, "You may leave Paris at any time." May joined her mother and brother at the seaside. When her mother learned that Abdu'l-Bahá's permission came the very day that Thomas became confirmed, she burst into tears and exclaimed, "You have indeed a wonderful master." May describes Thomas as being of medium height, slender, erect and graceful, with intense eyes and an indescribable charm. She learned that he had an important position in a cotton mill in a southern state of America, and usually spent long summer vacations in Europe. Before long, permission came from Abdu'l-Bahá for Thomas to make the pilgrimage. He was the first Englishman to go as a pilgrim. He traveled in the company of another young man, an American Baha'i. Upon their arrival at the house of Abdu'l-Bahá in Accra, they were ushered into a large room where they expected to find their master. A group of Eastern men stood at one end of the room. Thomas became distressed and disappointed, as he saw no one there who had any effect on him. He was afraid that he had failed to recognize the beloved master. Suddenly a door opened, and he beheld what seemed to him the rising sun. He sprang to his feet to approach the dazzling splendor and majesty of Abdu'l-Bahá. His despair instantly transformed to indescribable joy. What had troubled Thomas so much that he hoped for the master's forgiveness? He confided to Abdu'l-Bahá that although he had a high-paying position in a cotton mill, he realized that the child labor used there was wrong. Abdu'l-Bahá had three words: cable your resignation. Thomas instantly obeyed. Because of restrictions imposed by the civil authorities, Thomas could stay only 2 days in the prison city, Akka. Dr. Yunus Khan, a secretary for Abdu'l-Bahá, wrote his impressions, quote, "The fervor and the faith of this young man were so sublime in character that his blessed name shall ring throughout centuries and shall be remembered with deep affection in many chronicles. Verses from the Gospels, which attest to the glories of the kingdom, were always on his lips. Whenever he was in the presence of our peerless master, he was rapt in wonderment. The day he left, the master told him, 'Stay in Paris.' As bidden by the master, I accompanied him on his return journey to Haifa, the point of embarkation. Away from Akka, it was possible to entertain him for an hour or two in the home of one of the believers before his boat was ready to sail. We were in a room that looked towards Akka. There he would stand, every now and then perfectly still, facing Akka in a state of communion. While his eyes welled with tears, his tongue uttered words of supplication. In that state of ecstasy, he asked me whether he could correspond with me. My letters in answer to his, he said, would convey to him the fragrances of the effulgent city of Akka. We were all in tears when we bade farewell to him." End quote. Back in Paris, Thomas immediately became engaged in teaching the cause. May wrote, "He had become the guiding star of our group in the meetings he spoke with a simplicity and eloquence which won the hearts and quickened the souls. Whenever he visited May's family, he gave most of his attention to her mother, who had not recognized the station of Abdu'l-Bahá and was in need of love and kindness." May wrote, "His kindness and love to my mother during those days in Paris produced a great effect on her. He was always a joy and a consolation to her, before she understood the glory of the cause." Dear listeners, let us pause for a moment's reflection on the example of Breakwell's sensitivity and special kindness to May's mother. How often does it happen that when we are in the company of both believers and those who have not yet been touched, we sometimes ignore the latter because we have many things to talk about with our fellow Baha'is. May we always cause the spouse, the parents, relatives, and friends of believers to feel that they are included and loved as deeply as we love our Baha'i friends. Thomas's parents came to see him in Paris. They wanted him to return to London, but he explained to them that he must stay in Paris as the master had asked him to do so. Thomas led his father into the cause and enclosed his father's supplication to Abdu'l-Bahá with his own letter to Dr. Khan, Abdu'l-Bahá's secretary. Abdu'l-Bahá responded with a tablet for Thomas's father. Then there was a tragic development. Thomas was in the last stages of tuberculosis and in great pain. He wrote to Dr. Khan, that he found the suffering enabled him to draw nearer to his Lord. A few days after receiving this letter, Dr. Han relates that he was walking with the Master one evening when he turned to me and said, "Have you heard?" "No, Master," I replied, and he said, "Breakwell has passed away. I am grieved, very grieved. I have written a prayer of visitation for him. It is very moving, so moving that twice I could not withhold my tears when I was writing it. You must translate it well, so that whoever reads it will weep." This is what Abdu'l-Bahá wrote.
Here are some extracts from that eulogy. "O Breakwell, my beloved, where is thy beautiful countenance, and where is thy eloquent tongue? Where is thy radiant brow, and where is thy brilliant face? O my dear old Breakwell, where are thy bright eyes, and where are thy smiling lips? Where are thy gentle cheeks, and where is thy graceful stature? O my dear old Breakwell, verily thou hast abandoned this transitory world and soared upward to the kingdom, hast attained the grace of the invisible realm, and sacrificed thyself at the threshold of the Lord of Might. O my beloved, O Breakwell, verily thy Lord had chosen thee for his love, guided thee to the court of his holiness, caused thee to enter into the rezwan of his company, and granted thee to behold his beauty. O my beloved, O Breakwell, thou hast become a star in the most exalted horizon, a lamp among the angels of heaven, a living spirit in the supreme world, and are established upon the throne of immortality. O my adored one, O Breakwell, I mention thy name continually. I never forget thee. I pray for thee day and night, and I see thee clearly and manifestly. O my adored one, O Breakwell."
Dr. Han writes that a year later, Abdu'l-Bahá picked out an envelope unopened from the day's mail and said to him, "How pleasing is the fragrance that emanates from this envelope. Make haste to open it and see where it comes from." In it, there was a postcard colored a beautiful shade, and attached to it was one solitary flower. Written in letters of gold were these words, "He is not dead. He lives on in the kingdom of God. This flower was picked from Breakwell's grave. Praise be to the Lord that my son left this world for the next with the recognition and love of Abdu'l-Bahá." As soon as Dr. Han translated it, the Master at once rose up from his seat, took the card, put it on his blessed brow, and tears flowed down his cheeks. In a cablegram in 1957, on the passing of Hand of the Cause, George Townsend, the Guardian wrote that Thomas Breakwell, along with Mr. Townsend and Dr. Esselmont, were three luminaries shedding brilliant luster on the annals of the Irish, English, and Scottish Baha'i communities. Breakwell, the second of the three luminaries of the British Isles, is Hand of the Cause, Dr. John Esselmont. The Guardian also designated him as one of the 19 disciples of Abdu'l-Bahá. He was the author of Baha'u'lláh in the New Era, a book which the Guardian wrote is the textbook of the faith and would, quote, inspire generations yet unborn to tread the path of truth and service, end quote. It was first published in 1923 and has been in print continuously ever since, over 72 years, at the time of this presentation in 1996. In addition, it is translated into numerous languages. Who was this remarkable man? John Esselmont was born in Scotland in 1874 into a very distinguished family. He graduated from a medical school in Scotland with medals and honors, went on to win a research scholarship in pharmacology at a university in Germany. In addition to medical and scientific studies, he investigated many religious beliefs and was fluent in French, Spanish, German, Esperanto, and Persian. But the tragedy of his life was that he contracted tuberculosis while in college. In 1901, he went to Australia for 2 years, becoming a hospital staff doctor, also a district surgeon, and health officer in Alexander County. While in Australia, he was married briefly. He returned to Scotland, but for a better climate, soon proceeded to South Africa and worked there for 5 years. His next move was to Bournemouth, England, where he was the resident medical officer in a sanatorium for patients afflicted with tuberculosis. The treatment of the disease became one of Dr. Esselmont's principal interests. He developed a plan for the eradication of tuberculosis, which was presented to the British Medical Association, but it was not put into practice by the medical profession and government. However, his research and work in promoting a national health service culminated in the formation of the British National Health Service. He first heard of the Baha'i faith in 1914 from the wife of a colleague who had met Abdu'l-Bahá in London. He was instantly attracted to the teachings. He wrote, "They impressed me as meeting the great needs of the modern world more fully and satisfactorily than any other presentation of religion which I had come across." Dr. Esselmont's enthusiasm and happiness knew no bounds, and he quickly became involved in teaching the faith in Bournemouth, in both the sanatorium and the city itself. In 1916, he started writing a book on the faith. A friend, Major Tudor Pole, visited Abdu'l-Bahá in 1918 and spoke so highly of Dr. Esselmont's services that Shoghi Effendi commenced a correspondence with Dr. Esselmont, the beginning of a warm friendship. Dr. Esselmont received a tablet of encouragement and praise from Abdu'l-Bahá, who also requested to see a copy of his book. In November 1919, Dr. Esselmont arrived in Haifa to visit the master and brought the almost completed manuscript. At that time, there was also a group of American and Persian pilgrims. Dr. Esselmont interviewed them all and gained more material for the book. The most important source of information was, of course, the talks of Abdu'l-Bahá to the pilgrims. Dr. Esselmont stayed in Haifa for 2 months, and in that time took Persian language lessons, gave Esperanto lessons, and visited the sacred and historical places. Abdu'l-Bahá discussed his book with him and suggested that it should be shortened. Since he had just acquired a lot of new material from the other pilgrims, he decided to return to England and redo the manuscript. Abdu'l-Bahá planned to have it translated into Persian so he could correct and perfect it. It must not be forgotten that during his pilgrimage, Dr. Esselmont had the great bounty of meeting his engaging correspondent, the young Shoghi Effendi, and deepening their friendship. By August 1920, Dr. Esselmont sent the new manuscript to Abdu'l-Bahá, writing, "I hope the master will be pleased with it, but the more he alters it, the better I shall be pleased, for it is not my own ideas, but the Baha'i truths that I wish to present." The next month, Shoghi Effendi visited Dr. Esselmont in Bournemouth. As you recall, Shoghi Effendi went to England in 1920 to attend college at Oxford University. There is a short biography on Dr. Esselmont by Dr. Mojan Momen in which he writes, "To gauge something of the great mental energy of Dr. Esselmont, it should be realized that at this time, apart from his full-time work at the sanatorium, he was engaged in Persian studies, local and national Baha'i work, Esperanto work, and in addition, he had become secretary of the local League of Nations Union, where he hoped he might find individuals who would be interested in the faith. Because of the ever-increasing work of the faith, Abdu'l-Bahá was able to correct only 3.5 of the chapters of Esselmont's book by the time of his ascension in November 1921. Dr. Esselmont turned with eager devotion to Shoghi Effendi, who had to return to Haifa, and who through the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá was called to be the guardian of the Baha'i faith. He hoped Shoghi Effendi would be able to finish correcting the manuscript, which he did in early 1923, and wrote, "Your book, I am sure, is the finest presentation that has so far been given of the cause, and I am confident that it will arouse immense interest." It was published in England that same year and in America in 1924. His biographer writes, "The importance of Esselmont's book at the time was monumental. For 4 decades the faith had been spreading in the West, being taught by eminent Baha'is, each of whom had placed their personal interpretations and understandings upon it. Esselmont's book, so much more accurate, clearly written and easy to read, was a spark of light coinciding with the commencement of one of the most important periods of Baha'i history." Dr. Esselmont suffered times of incapacity due to poor health, but otherwise served the cause with all his energy. In 1922, he became a member of the National Spiritual Assembly of the British Isles. The next year, in April, the first spiritual assembly was formed in Bournemouth, but in the same month Dr. Esselmont left the city, as the sanatorium where he worked was sold and his position ended. He returned to his native city, Aberdeen, in Scotland, for the summer, and made several speaking trips throughout England and Scotland in 1923 and 1924. His physical condition made it imperative that he should not stay another winter in Scotland. The guardian, who was looking for an able assistant, extended him an invitation to come to Haifa, which he gratefully accepted, and arrived in Haifa in November 1924. He assisted the guardian in the translation of the Tablet of Ahmad, the hidden words and some passages from the writings of Baha'u'llah. 1925 found Dr. Esselmont struggling with more severe spells of illness. In November, 1 year after his arrival in Haifa, he suffered a fatal stroke, a complication of tuberculosis. He was only 51 years old. Shoghi Effendi stayed up all night with his dying friend. On Esselmont's finger, Shoghi Effendi placed his own Baha'i ring and helped carry the casket to the Baha'i cemetery on Mount Carmel, where it is interred next to a cousin of the Bab. The grief-stricken guardian wrote to the Baha'i world in part. On the 22nd November 1925, that memorable and sacred day in which the Baha'is of the Orient celebrated the twin festivals of the declaration of the Bab and the birthday of Abdu'l-Bahá, Dr. John E. Esselmont passed on to the Abha Kingdom. With tearful eyes, I supplicate at the threshold of Baha'u'llah and request you all to join in my ardent prayers for the fuller unfolding in the realms beyond of a soul that has already achieved so high a spiritual standing in this world. For by the beauty of his character, by his knowledge of the cause, by the conspicuous achievements of his book, he has immortalized his name, and by sheer merit deserved to rank as one of the hands of the cause of God.